This is Series 3 of Brave New You Tribe, and I'm Lou Hamilton, co-founder with Meredith Heppner Chapman of the clothing brand Brave New You. We welcome you to the stories of real-life Brave New Girls who are creatives, brand builders, entrepreneurs, health practitioners, and campaigners who have the courage to overcome challenges, push the envelope, and envision impactful possibilities for the future. This week's guest is Annika Somerville, market research consultant and author of Motherwhelmed and co-author of More Orgasms, Please. She now has a new book called How to Be a Boss at Aging, in which she gives real advice on how to navigate and embrace midlife. It's time to rip up the rule book and reinvent what your 40s and 50s can really look and feel like. Welcome, Annika, to Brave New You Tribe. Hi, Annika, how are you? Has your day been crazy so far?
It's been quite crazy. It's kind of like a typical Monday lockdown, I guess, because we're doing this in lockdown 3, aren't we? Which is the sequel that nobody wanted to live through. And I've dropped one kid off at childcare. I've luckily got my partner at home today, so he's helping with homeschooling with the other one. And I'm currently staring at an enormous pile of washing, which is just sat waiting to be hung up. So I always think it's quite funny because when you're sort of working from home, you're just continually surrounded by the domestic chaos, and it's not always good. So that ordinarily I would have loved to have been in a really nice environment so that I could be in the proper mindset, but instead in the back of my head I'm thinking, oh, that washing is going to start to get a bit smelly unless I hang it up soon.
Yeah, lockdown life, working, kids, got it all.
I know, it's difficult, isn't it? I think we're all feeling the strain a bit. I suppose I think certainly anecdotally, if I sort of go on a walk and I bump into anyone, I think the first time round, we were really sort of like, I'm fine. Whereas now people can't really even be bothered to talk. They're kind of just grunting at each other because I think it's just about, let's just, you know, plow through this time, please. I keep hearing people going, oh, it's good because February's really short. And so it's kind of like we just want it to go really quickly, don't we?
Yeah. And, you know, we are coming up for what, nearly a year. So I think we've done really well.
I know. I think if you'd said to me a year ago that we would be having this conversation, I would have just thought you were bonkers. You know, it does seem very strange. And I always feel like I have to qualify it by saying, you know, I'm really lucky because there's so many people who are much worse off, because otherwise it does sometimes. I know sometimes I'm worried that I'm complaining too much and I'm kind of like, oh, I shouldn't complain because it could be worse.
Everyone has their thing, that their challenge that they're having to deal with. And you know, it's not a comparison thing, is it? You know, in your life, in your circumstances, your shit is tough to get through. Luckily, we didn't know a year ago that we were going to have to do this for a year, because I think, you know, I think we are kind of having to sort of take it as it comes, aren't we? And not to think too far ahead. These circumstances have kind of really sort of pushed us to the max. It's been really heightened, and it feels like everything is intensified. Do you feel that you've learnt stuff about you that you hadn't kind of come to the realisation of before?
Oh, I mean, definitely. I think one of the difficulties I had was that my father died at the beginning of lockdown. So he died on the 27th of March last year, unexpectedly, and not COVID related. And so I think I sort of had the whole lockdown thing in a way kind of receded into the background. And so whereas a lot of my friends were getting very kind of anxious and worried, I was more in the kind of in the grief stage where nothing really seemed to matter. And in fact, even the news conferences to me sort of, I didn't really take an awful lot of notice of them. So one of the things I'd definitely say this year that I've learned is, and I think it's a bit of a cliche, but I'm kind of stronger than I thought I was. Like I always traditionally said to myself, you know, I'm an anxious person. I can't handle very much. I'd often have that negative voice sort of saying things like, you know, you can't handle this. This is too much for you. You can't deal with it, you know. But actually, you know, the evidence seems to show that I have dealt with it, and I've not been perfect. I mean, another thing I would say that I've learned, along with the fact that I'm probably stronger than I thought, is that I'm more angry than I ever thought I would be. I've had sort of really periods of where I've not been proud of my parenting, put it that way. I've been doing a lot of kind of shouting and shrieking and stuff. But overall, the year is one that I will reflect on, and I'll see it as being a real year where I was very, very sad, but I was also quite proud of how I managed to get through it. And I hope a lot of people listening will resonate with them too, because I think we all feel that probably, like you said, if we'd been said at the beginning of the year, you know, in a year's time, you're still going to be in this situation. Most of us would have just been like, there's no way, I won't deal with that. I would have gone mad. I won't be able to carry on. I'll just be lying like a heap on the floor. But the reality is that the majority of us, we might be suffering the load and all the kind of overwhelm, but we are getting through it in one way or another, aren't we?
Yeah, and I think that everything just feels exacerbated. And I think that's why your book, How to Be a Boss at Aging, is very timely, because it's sort of an intense version of everything that you've written about is heightened. You've been writing that book, presumably some of that writing was during lockdown, or editing at least.
All of it was in lockdown, actually. So, I mean, that's another strange thing that happened, was that I found that I was on furlough from my job. And so, in effect, I was lucky for the first bit of lockdown in that I was being paid, but I was at home. And there was a period, I think I had childcare as well. Anyway, there was a bit of time, and I suddenly sort of realised, I'd had a podcast before called The Hotbed, and I'd basically was like, do you know what? I want to think about a more diverse range of things. The Hotbed, we were concentrating, and we still do the podcast, on sort of sex and relationships and what happens in long-term relationships. But suddenly I found I was kind of in my late 40s, and it was almost like this tsunami of stuff was hitting me. And a lot of it was actually my father dying. That was the first thing. And then the realization that actually, you know, now that one of my parents had died, you know, I'd lost another parent earlier in my life and under quite traumatic circumstances. So all this kind of baggage, I think, just came floating up to the surface. And then I started thinking about, you know, what does my life actually, what does it amount to at the moment? And what does it mean? And what does it mean to be an older woman? And how do I feel about that? And I sort of realized, I think sometimes you get into your 40s and then suddenly you're 45, you know, it's like, what the hell's happened there? And then you're past 45 and then you're looking to the next, which is 50. And I didn't feel like I had, I mean, the book is quite lighthearted. It's fun. I've tried to put lots of advice in there as well. But essentially it was me just trying to work out, what does this mean? What is the next chapter of my life going to look like? And how am I going to sort of navigate through that? I've not hit perimenopause yet, or as far as I know, I haven't. Though having said that, I think a lot of the anger and the kind of hormonal shifts and stuff, I'm almost too scared to get it checked out, because I sort of feel, in a way, it would be good if I had a better understanding. But I just had a lot of, why is this happening? What is happening? And what can I do? You know,
it's a very interesting time, your 40s, because I think in your 20s, you've been kind of propelled through school into kind of, you know, university or first jobs. You've got a huge amount of energy. You think you're completely indestructible. You're kind of on this sort of hedonistic warpath and, you know, nothing is going to stop you. And, you know, yes, stuff happens and you kind of almost bat off, you know, one thing after another, and you're just sort of hell for leather to kind of live life to the full. And I think keeps you going, powers you on through your 30s, sort of almost kind of to the end of your 30s. And then I think you sort of run out of steam. And I think that's why your book is such a brilliant, useful Bible. And almost you need a midlife school at that age, where you just, everything that you've learned thus far is, you know, yes, great, you've learned all that, you've done all that, but now this is a whole new ballpark. I'm 57, nearly 57. So my 40s are quite a long time ago. And that was before really sort of social media and technology. And so, you know, there was much less sharing of information. So you really did feel like you were on your own and that this was only happening to you. And you describe it beautifully, like that your 40s are the U-bend. So it's all been going swimmingly so far. Then you hit the U-bend. and then kind of spat out the other side in your 50s. So tell me a bit more about the book and this the experience of being in the U-Bend.
I mean, it's interesting because I think everything you said that resonates. I mean, I can't believe that you're 57 because I'm looking on a screen at you as well as we're talking. So I think that's one of the things that I wanted to write about, is that our kind of traditional, the way that we sort of define getting older has shifted so radically. And so I think even when I look at my own gran, you know, who's, you know, she's departed now, but when she was 40, I probably didn't know actually when she was 40. Let's say when she was 50, 55, when she was my gran, she would have been wearing a sort of tan cardigan, a sort of A-line skirt. She was still very physically active, but she was seen as an old woman. You know, that's how society perceived her, is that she was an old woman. And in terms of kind of the menopause, or her going through the menopause, or, I mean, she would have just gone through that on her own. And there might have been the odd comment about, oh, you know, I'm feeling a bit hot and sweaty, and everyone would have laughed and joked, or she would have talked about, you know, being a bit muddled up. And then there was the whole stereotype of the kind of befuddled, silly, slightly crazy older woman, and there was all these kind of things. And I still think that we're in a different time now. We're in an exciting time because there's a role to redefine what aging is. Sometimes I think, and that's what drove a lot of the narrative of the book, was that for me, I was kind of like, I cannot keep going at the same speed. As in a very logical sense. So even though we're saying we're all ageless, and you know, age doesn't matter, it's kind of irrelevant, we can't really see whether somebody is 57 or 37 because we don't dress in the same way as we used to, and we're all still carrying on with work and careers and all the other stuff. I felt like I was just permanently exhausted, you know, and I felt like I was kind of looking around, and then I suddenly had this realization. I was like, of course you're exhausted because you're no longer 27. So you know, the kind of amount of energy that you put into your work without having children to look after, you're trying to do that. And then you're trying to do a million other things as well, because you sort of have that sense that, you know, time is finite, and so you need to, especially if you're on social media, it's like, oh, you need to have a book, and you need to have a podcast, and you need to have your own TV series, and, you know, somebody else is doing a book launch and their book's at number one, and what, and they've got six children, you know, and they've got a career doing sort of Zoom lessons, yoga online, and they've got, you know, and there's just an immense pressure. And I think part of it for me was that I am on social media a lot, and I am, the people that I tend to compare myself with are often writers. And I was just kind of like, listen, you do need to just acknowledge that this is a different time, and you can't go at it with the same amount of stamina. And B, you need to be a bit more discerning in terms of what you do want to do. So maybe it's actually quite a good thing to be thinking that I don't need this particular thing anymore, this belief. I've let go of that one. And I'm still massively ambitious, but I just have to acknowledge that I'm getting a bit older, because I almost feel like we've gone to the other extreme, that, you know, old age was about slowing down and sitting in a comfy chair by the fire and reading with a lap dog. And now it's kind of like, no, old age doesn't exist. So we just carry on, and we look at Jane Fonda and we think, Jesus, you know, she's in her 80s. And it's amazing, and it's brilliant, and it's inspiring, but it's also quite a lot of pressure if you're a woman who feels like she's kind of sinking under the strain of just so many demands. And a lot of them are self-imposed. You know, they're things that we've put on ourselves, pressures to become things. It's a double-edged sword. There's opportunity, but I think as we get older, we need to also think a little bit about, are we doing the things that we love because we want to do them, or are we doing them because we feel under this immense pressure to be a certain way because we live in this busy, you know, very vibrant, dynamic culture?
That's why I think your analogy of the U-bend is so useful, because it's not a continuum of sort of hell from 40 onwards, because it does feel like when you come into your middle 50s, depending on sort of how menopause decides to hold on to you or not, and you do feel like you come out of it, and there's this sort of sense of that your 40s is this chrysalis time where I actually read the other day what happens in a chrysalis, which is, and it's not nice, I think that, you know, everything that it was before gets pulverized and turns into pulp, and then the butterfly comes out the other end. And once you're through menopause, which thank God I am now finally, you can sort of look back and go, right, God, that was really, really tough, but it does feel different now. And so it is a finite period that you're kind of wrestling, and, you know, it feels really knotty and hard, but there is an end.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting, because I've spoken to other women who have come out the other side, and have actually interviewed a few people while I was writing the book, who were kind of saying, look, it's nice over here, you know, it's really spacious, and we don't have all the kind of hang-ups that we had before. And I can feel that, and I think many women in their 40s feel that they're on that journey. And I think that's important to learn, actually, is that it can feel tough at various times in your life, but there will be, I mean, hopefully it's for a reason. I think often when we experience a lot of difficulty and a lot of introspection, I think people are having it generally in lockdown, it results in a positive thing in the end. You know, we can do, I mean, that Glennon Doyle, I think she said in her book, it's kind of, we can do hard things and the hard things pay off in the end. So it's kind of worthwhile. But I think it's almost the 40s, it's a strange transitional period, because women are having children much later as well. You know, I had my children in my 40s, which is, you know, would have been unheard of years ago. So it means that suddenly there's so many things to sort of juggle at the same time and try. And then at the same time, I was like, what does work mean to me now? Because I had 20 years of working in a corporate environment where I worked so hard, and really just experienced headaches and burnout, but didn't realize that what it was. I just thought, well, this is just how everyone feels. And then now I'm sort of like, what does work mean now for the rest of my life? Because I really don't want to go, if I can help it, I don't want to go back into a corporate environment. I want to do work that's rewarding. So it's kind of suddenly just a million question marks of kind of, you know, what is going to happen here and what's going to happen there? What's going to happen in my relationship? You know, I'm in a long-term relationship, which is tricky. You know, long-term relationships are always tricky because it's, you know, it's up and it's down. And I feel like nothing is resolved at the moment. And my hope is that, not that I know that it won't be resolved, but by the time I get into my sort of mid-50s, that either I just don't care so much, so I'm kind of like, well, you know, whatever. Or I can just be, I think I sort of said in the book, it's a bit about just taking your foot off the accelerator. You know, I'm just kind of, hopefully I'm poodling along. And maybe some of it is about knowing your limitations as well, because I think that's the other thing, is that I hope by then I'm kind of like, listen, this is okay. This, you know, that your life as it sits at the moment is good, and enjoy that.
You go into so many areas in the book, and I think that's really important, because it isn't just one thing or another. And each chapter, I mean, really, we could do an episode on each chapter, but each chapter is really, really important, because it is a different theme that you're experiencing, and it sort of feels like there's kind of hardship in every area that you look at. But you do offer hope in each one, and you do give a kind of tools to cope with those things. So you look at parenting, relationships, aging, grief, perimenopause, old traumas coming to the surface, which I thought was really interesting, that sort of once this kind of frenetic period of your 20s and 30s is gone, that those old traumas have risen. And so the anxiety, the migraines, the worse hangovers, the body image that you, I'm not sure with body image, whether is it an exaggerated version of how you've always felt, or does it go into this whole other new world? So first of all, I'd like to talk about the old traumas coming up and how that sort of affects the increased anxiety and sort of possibly migraines. Definitely hit me sort of late 40s, early 50s, and a massive amount of anxiety. But that was, I'm pretty certain that was perimenopause.
I think part of it is that, like you said, like when you're working and perhaps always projecting forward, because when you're in your 20s and 30s, you're kind of thinking about, you know, when I get on the property ladder, when I, you know, when I get maybe hopefully my first flat, you know, when I kind of earn a certain amount of money, then that will deliver happiness. You know, when I have children, I will be happy. And then if you're lucky enough that you've actually got some of those things in your 40s, and you question, you sort of go, I'm still not happy. Like, what the hell is going on? Because, you know, in a way, I mean, I'm not wealthy, but I have a lot of things I should feel grateful about. And I think specifically if you're in a period like now where there's kind of lots of different things that are coming together. So we're sort of stuck inside. Maybe if you're in your 40s and 50s, you've got anxiety, and then past trauma just starts to come to the surface. And I think it's quite common. I spoke to Dr. Becky Quick, who she's a psychologist that deals specifically for women in menopause. And she was saying, you know, menopause is often a time where the crows sort of come home to roost, which sounds a bit ominous, but effectively the kind of stuff that you've shoved in a bag, trying to, you know, not think about it and just keep going, you know, plow your own furrow, keep going forward. Suddenly you become a bit more reflective about, because you're aging. So, and people perhaps around you, for me, the trigger was that when my father died, suddenly I was kind of like, okay, you know, my father died. And that means that actually, it sounds very depressing, but I said it in the book, you know, I'm the next in line now, because kind of like, you know, once your parents have kind of gone, you realize that you're stepping up into, not hopefully not in the very near future, but it did make me really think about the past, you know, and think about things that I'd been through with him. And that because we'd lost, my stepmother, unfortunately, committed suicide when I was 15, and she did it. She was suffering from postpartum psychosis. And so she killed herself and killed my sister at the same time, who was a baby. So that whole thing, which for many people is traumatic and triggering, that was kind of buried for many, many years. And in fact, my father and I never, ever really discussed it. You know, we were very close, but we both decided that it was too awful a thing. So we kind of buried it. So I think most of my life, I found that I was suffering with a lot of physical symptoms of anxiety, things like headaches, which I was usually, the way that I was dealing with headaches in the work was that I was taking painkillers, and that's just how I would address it. So I'd get a headache, I'd take painkillers, shove it away. And then suddenly when I got to, you know, mid 40s, I was like, you know what, if I can't go down this, I mean, I still take painkillers actually for headaches, which is interesting, but I'm trying to develop a bit more of an understanding of what, why am I getting these headaches? And usually it's tension and it's stress, you know, and it's kind of, and where is that stress coming from? Well, one of the big stresses is if you have something very traumatic happen and you just pretend that it didn't happen, and then the person that it happened to, that you kind of shared that history with, is gone, and you're kind of, and then suddenly, in a way, it's interesting, the whole butterfly thing, because I think it's a painful process. I haven't been through therapy or anything, but I felt like in order for me to heal, I needed to talk about it and get it out there. And obviously, I mean, I have, you know, other family members who would probably disagree and would say that's not a good thing to talk about it. But for me personally, and for people who have lost people in the past and are struggling, I know that if I read, I love reading books, and, you know, I'm a really avid reader and listening to podcasts. The times that have really helped me is listening to somebody else recount a story and telling people how they got through it and the things that has helped them to get through it. I'm not saying that I'm some sort of lovely charitable person, but it's kind of part of me is hoping that if someone listens and something traumatic has happened to them, whatever the shape of that trauma, that actually it's not unusual for that to resurface again, and that, you know, you can survive it, you know, and you can go on to have a happy life or have a content life. But I think the whole trauma thing, I think part of it as well is that you're thinking more. My mum always said this to me. She said, oh, you know, you get to a stage where you spend a lot of time reflecting and less time projecting forward. And I think maybe your 20s and your 30s and the early 40s are all about projecting forward. And then you get to the sort of this point and you're like, you are thinking about the past and your role in it and making peace with it, I guess.
So if you are in this cocoon of a series of pain points, what are the ones that you find most challenging?
Well, I mean, there is a lot of them. I'm writing a new book at the moment, actually, about sort of grief. And so one of the biggest ones for me is obviously just processing grief. You know, that's a massive pain point of kind of trying to, you know, reconcile yourself with the fact that when you lose somebody, and I think that's kind of what I'd forgotten about grief or never really learned, is that it you can't fix it as a problem. So basically, we're in a society where we have an app because we can't sleep, and we have an app to meditate, and you know, we know how many steps we're doing. And our natural thing, and certainly when my dad died, my natural instinct was I picked up my phone and I looked for answers on my phone. I was kind of like, you know, okay, there must be something on here that tells me how. There's a grief app. There must be an app. There must be like a 7-week course I can do to sort out this grief because I'm not enjoying it. You know, there must be some sort of way of contacting him, you know, in the afterlife on my phone. There must be an app. I was completely bewildered by the fact that there was no end point, you know, and I think that's the thing, certainly with grief generally, is that the feeling will continue until you die yourself, but the only thing that will happen is that it will vary in severity from one day to the next. And so, you know, one thing that is a specific kind of pain point. But then I think with the age that I am, there's quite a lot of regret as well. You know, I wish I have a lot more confidence now than I ever did, and I look back and I sort of think, oh, the amount of situations I got myself into where, you know, specifically work situations where I just felt so insecure and I didn't say what I should have said, and I let people make me feel smaller. And, you know, even, I mean, it's changed so much, but even the level of sexism that I tolerated in the workplace, and there wasn't really sexual harassment, but there were comments made, which I accepted as normal, you know, looking at a bunch of CVs. I mean, I was a managing partner for a company, so I worked up my way up to the top, looking through CVs, and, you know, a colleague saying to me, you know, we just need to divide them into the women that I'd fuck and the women I wouldn't fuck, you know, and me laughing at that and thinking that that was, and this isn't even that long ago. It's a great time now in that I won't put up with as much shit really as I used to put up with. But then I think sometimes you know there's a lot of the people, what would you say to younger self? And I'm just kind of like, why did you put up with so much shit from other people for so long, and why did you sit in a career that you really, it didn't suit you, but you were too scared to try something else? So I think there's a bit of regret, and there's still sort of processing the grief. And the grief thing is a good analogy, because I think when you get older, even if you're not grieving for someone, an individual that you've lost, you're grieving for a certain life that you had. And for women as well, it's all tied up as well with the way that we look, the way that society sees us. You know, I think Nora Ephron said, you know, she wished that she'd worn a bikini more often when she was younger. You know, it's like, I had very poor body confidence all through my 20s. And so I, you know, I didn't wear bikinis and I didn't like my body, and I would go on the beach and I would wait until I thought there were as few as people as possible. And then I would try and get in the sea. And then I didn't want to get out of the sea because I knew people would see me. So I'd try and position my towel as close to the water as possible so that I could sort of almost crawl out of the water and get the towel around my body as quickly as possible. And now I just think, goodness, you know, that was my little window of probably looking, you know, never looking like a supermodel, but just, you know, looking okay. And how sad that I felt so bad about myself. And I always think that now. I sort of think, God, if I can get that in my own daughter's minds, like, just, oh, if you can try and get the mindset that you have as a 40 something, but as a 20-year-old, and that's quite a powerful combination.
And so how do you feel about your body now then, in your 40s, post kids?
Really bad. I mean, I feel better than I did, in that over lockdown I took up exercise. I was one of these cliches who basically decided to do, I do like an online workout, and I do it 4 times a week, and I'm not mega fit, but I'm better than I was, because my youngest daughter's only 2. So, you know, it took a while. But I still don't, I feel like it's difficult, because there's this strange thing where I feel much more confident in myself, but now my body is actually deteriorating. So I'm kind of like, I'd love to be one of those women. And this is what I think is kind of the myth, is that when you read a lot of magazine interviews with older women, they're like, I don't care what people say about the way I look, because I'm just so confident. And, you know, I love wearing a bikini and I'm running down the beach. And, you know, there'll be these amazing, the unspoken thing about it, which I flagged up in the book, which nobody really seems to acknowledge, is that those images aren't real. you know. So, and so the older woman who's looking at them is sort of going, oh, I should be feeling, that's right, I'm in my 40s, I should be feeling really confident. I should be feeling like, you know, accepting myself. You know, look, you're still being sold an image which is unrealistic and unobtainable for the average woman. Maybe what I would love to see, and I think it's just a bit more of a reality check of actually people saying, do you know what, I do look bloody amazing, but that's because I have a facial every day and I have 2 hours of Pilates, I've had, you know, cosmetic surgery, I've had a hair transplant, you know, I have, you know, 2 or 3 hours of sports massage every day. I only ever eat protein. You know, I just think that's more realistic, isn't it? And then we don't feel so bad. You know, I've always said my ambition is just not to look knackered. You know, I don't want to look tired. You know, I just don't. So for me, it's not actually about aging. It's just, I think when you're young and you have a hangover the next day, you still look okay. You know, you look pale. And then as you get older, your face sort of becomes the face that you have, you know, the hangover face, even when you've had sleep. I mean, it's an interesting time to be older because I think there's so many, and I do talk in the book about going and having Botox, but I felt very conflicted about it. And I still do, you know, I still feel that, you know, my poor stepmom, who is a feminist, my mum, who is definitely a feminist, would be mortified that, you know, women were resorting to doing these things, because they'd say, you know, you're kind of conforming to the patriarchy, you know.
What would you say to the phrase, aging is a feminist issue?
Yeah, well, it definitely is, isn't it? I think at the moment it's interesting in that the way that we define ourselves as feminists and the choices that we make are changing and shifting. You know, so I came from a really, the second wave feminists, my mum and my stepmum were quite radical. I'm using the term radical, but at the time it seemed radical in that, you know, they didn't shave their legs. They didn't wear makeup for a period of time in the 80s. This was, you know, you went to Greenham Common, you had to wear a jumpsuit. There was kind of almost like a whole code. There was a bank of like a feminist handbook. You know, you definitely wouldn't be getting Botox. You know, you wouldn't be, there's all these things that you couldn't do. And it was quite, in a way, it was quite prescriptive. In another way, it was kind of imposing rules on women that were just a different set of rules, because it was kind of saying, you know, instead of, you know, wearing tan tights and heels and makeup, you've got to not shave your legs. And, you know, and I grew up as a teenager and I was like, shit, the first thing I'm going to do is I got to shave my legs. I got to, you know, because you rebel against your context. I think there's still a sort of question mark in that. What does an older feminist look like? And how do we reconcile ourselves with the desire, that the personal desire we have, the vanity we have? Personally, I want to look good and I want to look good for myself. That's what I say. But of course, I am influenced by the overriding culture that I live in.
Well, I think that's what you describe in the book, is that you have a choice. You can say, well, I am going to have Botox, or you can say, I'm definitely not going to have Botox, and that's my choice, and that's how I decide, that's how I'm choosing to age as a feminist, because I'm in charge of my choices. And it's less and less about, you know, what guys are thinking about you, if that was ever a thing, and more about sort of how you're feeling about yourself.
Yeah, it's really hard, because I think a lot of the industry plays on our insecurities. And so I think it's really difficult, because I think you're judged, and I think I said this in the book, you're judged if you do things, and you're equally judged if you don't. You know, you're kind of, and you're put in a box in terms of, you know, you're a hag, or you're kind of very glowing. You know, they'll always use these, they won't actually come out and say it, you know, but I hope, I mean, I, you know, these things are not that controversial, I don't feel. Like, I think if you look at the fact that, you know, if you get hairs growing out of the bottom of your chin, you're going to pull them out. Yeah, you're not going to want to do that. And that happens as you get older. You know, you start to produce, I think it's probably because you produce more testosterone or some sort of hormonal imbalance. You're going to maybe dye your roots, and you know, everyone's going to do that. And actually, for me, taking the next step and sort of having Botox periodically, because I don't have it all the time, for me, that doesn't feel that different in terms of kind of self-maintenance and self-care. And I suppose my only question mark is, you know, as long as I don't lose perspective, and I think that's how a lot of women worry, you know, you worry, you sort of, you know, if I talk to friends about it, they go, oh my God, I don't want to end up looking really weird. You know, I'm going to, you know, have a face like I've been in a wind tunnel and all these other things. I think that's okay. I mean, what I wouldn't want to do, and I think that's the thing with the book, is that I'm trying to say to you, yeah, it is, the choice is yours. If you want to do it, do it. If you don't want to do it, don't do it.
You're not being prescriptive, but you're offering different choices.
Yeah.
Up against the problems and the issues that we feel that we're going through. I found that as I got older and into my 50s, and probably through the pain of menopause and migraines, my focus became much more about health and the fear of chronic illness and pain. And so I think it's that in a way migraines have been a, hesitate to say gift, but I really don't want to suffer the pain that they give me, and so I will do anything and investigate everything until I find something that helps that, and that's going to the sort of the root cause of it. And you know, I'm a vegan, so I know that there are deficiencies, so I kind of find the things that I have to balance out. And I gave up drinking in the hope that that would do it, but it hasn't had a single one iota impact on the migraines. But I have found that in trying to be sort of more healthy because of those things, I've felt better about myself.
It's funny because that's actually one area where I feel like I still got a bit more investigation to do. If I have a problem, I want to fix it, so then I'll try and work. But what I haven't become fully equipped to do at the moment is almost being more preventative and sort of thinking, hang on a minute, you keep having this issue, why don't you just try and backtrack about a bit and think about why that is. Certainly I do think more about what I eat. I haven't done enough investigations into things like supplements and things. Like I feel like I need to do more about that. And I think once I start hitting perimenopause, you know, I will be doing more of that. I'm trying to work out what's going to make me feel better and healthier. And I'm on a bit of a journey, but I think at the moment I'm definitely not where I need to be. With alcohol, I mean, I do talk about alcohol, and I know that there's a direct correlation with drinking and anxiety for me. So it doesn't make sense for me to drink. And so I go through periods of time where I drink a small amount and periods when I'm not drinking at all. And I know that I always feel better when I'm not drinking, but that's more, it's definitely the anxiety that it dials up in me. And it took me bloody 20 odd years to realise that once you eliminate alcohol, you can get rid of some of that anxiety, not all of it.
When you describe the tougher sides of being in your midlife, mainly 40s, you talk about judgment, rigidity and routine. And then when you talk about the things that can help you get through the struggles and the challenges, you describe that as non-judgment, flexibility and change. And I think that's really interesting, isn't it? That one is very, very fixed and one is much more fluid. And so how do you get from feeling very fixed and holding it all together, but allowing yourself to somehow become much more like a bamboo? So you're still strong, but you're much more flexible and able to change and go with the flow.
It's very interesting because I think I am very controlling, and in certain areas of my life I'm more controlling than others. So with parenting, I'd love to say that I was fluid and flexible, but I have a very strict routine. Well, it's not very strict, but it's just that we have to be up at, you know, they are up at a very early time anyway, but you know, dressed, there's a certain schedule in place. Otherwise I feel like I'm losing my mind because I have to have some sort of parameters. Some routine is, you need some routine. I think when it's about, one thing I've learned is that I always said to myself, you can't do this and you can't do that. And that was more on a professional level. So I've always said the thing that I said, I'm really rubbish at technology. I'm not very good. I mean, there's a whole list of things, maybe, you know, 50 things that I feel like I can't do them. And what I try and do now is if the opportunity comes up, the voice comes in and it says, you can't do that. You know, you can't do that. You're not very good at that. And then I say yes to the opportunity to do the thing which makes me feel very uncomfortable. Acknowledge that, okay, you've not done this thing before, but that doesn't mean you can't do it now. A whole wealth of things hopefully opens up, you know, and you can try new things. And I feel like when I look at people who have aged badly, what's happened is that as they've got older, their world has got smaller. So effectively, they've become more judgmental of other people. They've become more fully like, I don't do that. I don't do that. I don't like that. I won't try that. I'm not going to do that. I don't like people who do that. And their list of things that they don't like becomes longer and longer and longer and longer. And the list of things that they do like becomes smaller and shorter, you know. And it robs you of any joy, but it also it makes you old because, you know, you see something on the TV and you go, I don't like that. I don't like the language. I don't like the language. I don't like the sex in it. I don't like the actors. I think the actors are not highly trained. Or I don't like that art. It's too modern. It's not proper painting. That doesn't work. You know, I don't like it that, you know, there's a whole range of sort of people that you see and you hear and you're just like, that's what being old is about, is it, you shut everything down and you become very rigid in your outlook.
Yeah, well, when you're in your 20s, you say yes to everything and you take risks and you leap before you think, and maybe sort of going sort of full circle and kind of allowing yourself to be a bit more kind of, or a lot more open, and saying yes to things that you don't know what the outcome, you know. But we sort of tend to get a bit more cynical, and so we try and kind of, you know, we think we know what's going to happen if we do this, so well, why would you bother? Whereas actually, just kind of borrowing from your 20-year-old self and saying, well, let's just give it a go, let's try.
Exactly.
You have a lovely line at the end of your book which says, what do you want your life to look like, and what steps are you going to take to get there today? So if I were to ask you that, what would you say?
My ambition is really to keep on moving forward as a writer. So in order to do that, I do have to actually commit to writing at least every day. So I think for me, every day has to have a little bit of time when I'm writing. My juggle a little bit is that because I had my kids late, I'm really ambitious about what I want to achieve. And now that I have the children, I'm like, I'm really frustrated because they require so much time and energy because they're small, you know, whereas I've got friends who had kids much earlier than me and their kids are now teenagers and fully independent-ish. I mean, that's a myth. They're not. They need lots of attention, but in a different way. So I want, one of my friends said to me, she said, you know, you can't just have your ambition that you want to have success, you know, on a level of being a writer or a broadcaster. You need to have, you know, what about your parenting? You know, do you want to be, how does that fit in? And I think that's what I'm trying to juggle at the moment, is I'm kind of like, okay, they're not always compatible. You know, I think something has to give. And so for me, I try at least, if I can, to think about the way that I'm parenting and get better at it. I want to get to a point where hopefully I'm not looking back and thinking, you were so consumed with your own bloody self that you didn't have anything to do with the children and now you regret that. But I think it's always useful to do an exercise where you basically think, you know, it sounds a bit sad, but kind of, you know, where do I want to be? And is the other decisions that I'm making today getting me there or not? But hopefully what I'll do is I'll probably, you know, it's little things, having a walk outside, having some social contact with somebody, doing some writing, attempting to be a reasonable parent and not shouting. Those are all things that are taking me in the right direction.
So in the middle of your chrysalis and all of this sort of transformation happening and the sort of the tough side and the good side, how would you define courage in that context?
I think courage is probably being able to acknowledge that life is really hard and difficult and that you're going to have difficult feelings, and to sort of lean into those feelings, acknowledge that they're happening, don't try and push them away. And it is about sort of navigating your way through, so kind of having a having good days and having bad days, but you're continuing on the journey, and you're kind of basically not giving in. The funny thing is, and I think we come round circle, that you can't really see that you've been courageous until after you've done it. You know, I still have very bad anxiety. And basically now the only difference is that I say to myself, oh, I've got anxiety now. I can feel it. You know, I can feel that my stomach is churning. I've got my heart rate has picked up. I'm feeling really uncomfortable. But I know the thing is in the back of my mind, I know that it will pass. So I'll probably think, what can I do in the moment? What can I do? Well, I'm going to go for a walk outside. I better get an early night tonight. You know, there's little things that I do. But what I don't do is before I would feel it and I'd pretend that it wasn't happening. And then I'd probably find ways to numb it. Whereas actually, once you acknowledge that there are very unpleasant feelings right now, you know, there's sadness, there's, you know, there's kind of worry and disappointment and frustration, and you almost go, oh, I feel really frustrated. Okay, what can I do? And sometimes actually you can't do anything. You just have to go, oh God, I'm just gonna have to feel frustrated and deal with it. But it's facing up to your feelings, I think.
Well, thank you so much, Aniki, for helping those who are going through their midlife, whether that's a crisis or a chrysalis or however they want to see it. Know that they're not alone in what feels like a gnarly, knotty time, and that by supporting one another, slowing down and taking pressure off ourselves, we can get through it and get out to the less pressurized times ahead.
I know, I'm looking forward to those. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Aniki. See you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Aniki, for bringing out a book that shows us that the tough times we experience in our midlife is entirely normal, and that there is hope on the other side. You can find out more about Aniki's work on www.anikisomervilleisworking.com and follow her on Instagram at @AnikiSomerville. Thanks also to Podstar PR for producing the series, and to you, our tribe, for listening. Download, rate and review on your podcast provider so that we can keep bringing you this free podcast. Goodbye for now, and see you next time.